that precedent of every Jew in the world having a right to return to, like, you know, where they say they found, like, a stone plate from 5,000 years ago, which, of course, I mean, you can do that for, like, anywhere.
Hmm.
It's, like, the most insane thing I've ever heard. Like, expand that to anyone else. There are things along the Volga River where ethnic Germans live. So anyone from Wisconsin can go there and just kick a Russian out.
And lay claim to it.
Yeah. No, it's, if you extrapolate it to any other group, any other territory, it just, you realize how insane it is.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's sacrosanct.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, when you look at kind of the tactics and the strategy that Israel employs on the land, it's very much like textbook colonialism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, taking the higher ground, dividing the population, dividing them geographically, but also kind of creating different classes of Palestinians. So one thing that a lot of people kind of have a difficult time wrapping their heads around is we don't have a society of Israelis and Palestinians. We have a society of Israelis who, wherever they are in this land, whether it's inside what we call Israel proper, which is, you know, Israel's 1948 borders, or settlements in the West Bank or in Jerusalem or anywhere, they have the same rights and privileges as any other Israeli Jew, right? So if you're an Israeli Jew living in Tel Aviv, you have the same rights and privileges as an Israeli Jew living in Maale Adumim, which is one of the biggest settlements in the West Bank. Like deep in the heart of the West Bank, not on the border, deep inside, close to the Jordan border, actually, right? You are subject to Israeli civil law, so you commit a crime, it's the Israeli police that will come, and you'll be taken to court, you'll face a jury of your peers, you vote in the same elections, you have kind of the same entitlements from the Israeli government in terms of health care, in terms of education, etc., etc. If you're a Palestinian, your rights depend on where you live and the ID that Israel has granted to you. So Israel grants every single Palestinian born in that territory an ID card and an ID number. And based on that, your life, the trajectory of your life, is determined by certain Israeli laws.
This glorious, finally cooling off May 14th, I believe, or is it 13th? Welcome to another.
This is June 10th. Did you just say May 14th?
I meant June. Shush. No, I didn't. You didn't hear that. Welcome to this wonderful June 10th edition of The Truth is So Boring. I am your sleepy co-host, Owen.
And I'm the slightly less sleepy co-host. No, I'm not sleepy at all. What am I saying? I'm Scott.
The awake one. Stealing other people's jokes. Okay. So, last month, before I went to sleep for a month straight.
Yeah.
No, 2 weeks ago, we discussed the early history of the what has been referred to as a bit messily as the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Yeah, and this episode is a continuation of that. In that episode, we covered I'll go into it in a minute, but I just wanted to say that, like, if you're listening to this, I hope that you will go back and listen to the first episode if you have not heard it.
There's a lot of useful context there.
Yeah, I mean, before drawing conclusions, because there is context that, you know, we are leaving out of this because we put it in the last one, because there's just so much to cover, we couldn't do it in 1 hour. So in the previous episode, we covered much of the history of the region currently known as Palestine as we had time for. Israel and Judah were two kingdoms which existed during overlapping periods for less than 500 years each, more than 2,500 years ago. In the mid-19th century, British Christians began a campaign to recreate the historic Kingdom of Israel as an ethnically Jewish state for the exclusive use by the descendants of the inhabitants of Israel. In typical British style, this took the form of a settler colonial movement, which is still ongoing to this day.
In the second half of that episode, we covered a selection of common media tropes used to push for the continuation of this movement of the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, of the continued encroachment on native territory by what can only be described in my mind as colonial forces. Mm-hmm. Let's see. It's not that it isn't complicated, but the way in which people claim this issue is complicated is often used to just obfuscate the fact that, like,
it's used to keep the debate going.
Yeah, instead of, you know, try to reach a conclusion, let's just circle around and around and around about whether or not, you know, this philosophical idea matters.
Well, I don't know why you went on that
not
tangent.
Know either.
The list of the media tropes that we gave in the last episode, and there was a lot more detail on this, just to cover them briefly, was: does Israel have a right to exist? Israel has a right to defend itself. Nonviolence as an imperative, for one side. Hamas is firing indiscriminately. Number 5, it's not a complex issue. And number 6, I don't think, no, that's not. That's
6
part
isn't
of number
a myth.
5. That's part of number 5. So on the Hamas firing indiscriminately, I see Owen has some extra notes here. Is this for this particular situation, or is this historical? This is for just this, this May?
This is like the past 100 years or so, starting with around like the mandate.
No, the deaths that you have listed here under Hamas is firing indiscriminately. Do you have the notes up?
I do. We're looking at different parts. I'm at the top. Oh.
Anyway, the
that's cumulative.
For
this year.
Okay, for this year. Okay, so for this year, there have been 13 Israeli deaths, 12 quote unquote civilians, and for Palestinian, there were 277 deaths.
At least.
Between it's funny, the Palestinians claim that you must have these backwards. The Palestinians claim that 220 civilians were killed, and the IDF claims that 20 civilians were killed. Which I'm pretty sure that there were more. There were like 60 children, so that means the IDF is
wrong
claiming,
either way.
Claiming that they're claiming that the children were
not part of the count.
Yeah, we're not civilians, they were military, and that's kind of messed up.
Oh, that's something we love to do here in America. That was one of Obama's favorite media tactics.
Oh, really?
Yeah. We'll bomb them now, and we'll call them all
militants.
I
remember
in
hearing
hindsight,
about that.
And what the press will call them, so everyone will believe it.
The military defines anyone who was a target of one of their operations as a militant, regardless of what they were doing.
Anything.
Anyway,
or their age, or anything pertinent.
And injuries were 119 Israeli injuries to at least 3,400 Palestinian injuries. So the idea that Hamas is firing indiscriminately is a little...
They
both are, you know.
So, okay. Yeah, they both are. Although, judging by the body count, it seems like the IDF is a little bit better at killing its targets than Hamas is.
Yikes.
Also, as we will discuss a little bit later today, Israel has the Iron Dome, which is a highly advanced, like, modern missile defense system that intercepts at least 90%, I've seen quoted in, like, CBS articles and stuff, of all incoming missiles. And also, like, Hamas doesn't have that type of protection. Not Hamas, Palestine, excuse me. Here, look, here I go making the exact mistake we're trying to undo. Okay. Meanwhile, like, they also don't have access to the top-grade rockets in the first place that Israel has access to by way of being a first world nation, quote unquote. And
right. Part
so,
of that.
So the rockets that that quote unquote Hamas is shooting are likely to not be very accurate in the first place.
Right. Yeah. And as a part of that conversation about the indiscriminate firing, it talks about, or maybe this was something else that I was listening to, talks about the trope of Hamas using human shields, being like, oh, they'll set up in the basement of an apartment building, so we have to, like, you know, set off a small bomb on the top of the apartment building and get, tell all the civilians to run out, but the bad guys won't leave. We'll just bomb those guys whenever we blow up an apartment building that was, you know, hundreds of people's home.
Great logic. I'm using scare quotes here.
Anyway, so what should we talk about next? Do you want to talk about
Palestinian
history?
Well, let's get the collapse update out of the way.
Oh, yeah. I meant to have a bunch of stuff for this, but I didn't have time to prepare it. I just have one headline real quick. Rates of Parkinson's disease are exploding. A common chemical may be to blame.
Sorry.
That's not funny. Don't make fun of people with Parkinson's.
I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. That's not fair to them.
Yeah, basically, there's a common household cleaning product that people who work with it are 6 times more likely to get Parkinson's disease. So that's fun. And
that chemical is used in dry cleaning, shoe polish, and carpet cleaner.
Yeah, it's not really much of an update. Hopefully, I'll have a better one next week.
We can also just quickly shoot off how microplastics are sterilizing us all.
Oh yeah,
the human race will not be able to reproduce in like about 60 years.
Yeah.
We were just having a little chat about this over dinner yesterday. You know, light dinner conversation about relatively apocalyptic subjects.
That's
anyway.
Always how it goes at the dinner table around me. So do you want to get into some Palestinian history, or should we go on to the interview clips?
I mean, I'm sure everyone's seen the disappearing Palestine map, and if you haven't, you can just search those words, and you'll probably be able to find an approximation of what I'm talking about. Just basically details about the populations of ethnic Palestinians and Jews in the Israel-Palestine area, the contested area, the Levant, whatever you want to call it. The bulk of Zionist population has arrived in Palestine during the 4th and 5th Zionist immigration waves, also known as the Aliyot. I believe I'm saying that wrong. But that was between 1924 and 1939. But that means that the majority of those demanding partition of the land at the time had barely been living there for more than 20 years. Mm. And meanwhile, we're talking about Palestinians who had been settled there for a few hundred years. Because that area had been under Ottoman rule for several hundred at that point.
Yeah, this comes back to that article you sent me the other day about, what was that quote? A people without a land for a land without a people.
Yeah, it's a land without a people for a people without a land.
Yeah,
but
whatever. The idea that there weren't people who were living there is a myth. There were. It's just that, like, the British colonialists didn't consider them worth considering.
Oh yeah, that's the colonialist idea of terra nullium, which is the assumption that lands that aren't already colonized are and it's a very it started with Christianity, like it started as a Christian term, and then like it was like secularized and sanitized in media a few hundred years later due to the Enlightenment. But I think the term came after. Like, I think this is a term that a historian used and like caught on within circle, because like it helps to describe what was happening. Not like, oh, we're gonna just use this word to justify what we're doing. But it was the idea that those lands were empty and not being utilized because they weren't quote unquote developed or whatever.
And this is the exact same idea that you see in the the colonization of the Americas.
Oh yeah.
The with homesteading and other expansionist movements in the early days of the American colonial project. Would you like to listen to the interview clips, or would you like to go over the timeline of the events?
I think we'll just keep the timeline in our back pockets in case need to update some. Because this interview was from a few weeks ago, so the numbers are going to need a little bit of updating.
Sure. And just before we get into that, I just figured I'd take a note. It's currently 9:18 a.m. You're listening to The Truth Is So Boring on WIOX Community Radio. This is part two of a two-part episode on Israel and Palestine. So if you have not heard part one, check out thetruthissoboring.org.
So this is Felix, joined by journalist for AJ Plus, that's Al Jazeera Plus, Mohammed Al-Safin, for a wide-ranging discussion on Palestinian resistance and the future of Zionism in the Palestinian cause. We're going to be hearing from Mohammed Al-Safin for the next 40 minutes or so.
I'm playing. You have me down.
To start off, let's talk about what Sheikh Jarrah is and where it is. It's a Palestinian neighborhood. It's quite small in occupied East Jerusalem. That's Israeli-occupied East Jerusalem. One of the things that Israel has been doing ever since it occupied East Jerusalem is it has a kind of target ratio for demographics. It wants to maintain the number of Palestinians in Jerusalem at 40% to 60% Israeli Jews. This isn't a secret. This isn't some kind of, you know, hidden reporting or investigative journalism that had to reveal this. This is clearly stated in the plans for the municipality of Jerusalem. It's part of Israeli government plans. And the idea is always to maintain a stable Jewish dominance in terms of demographics in the city. And to that end, what Israel has been doing since 1967 when it occupied East Jerusalem and then in the 80s when it formally annexed it is building Israeli settlements in and around the Palestinian neighborhoods and villages that make up East Jerusalem. It set its eyes on Sheikh Jarrah because strategically it's important. If it takes Sheikh Jarrah, then it comes ever closer to completely encircling the main Palestinian neighborhoods around the old city of East Jerusalem. Since the 80s, what it's done is it has allowed settler organizations, including settler organizations that are registered in the United States as nonprofit organizations, to take the people who live in Sheikh Jarrah, the Palestinian residents, to court, to Israeli court, and claim that the land they live on is actually Jewish property, and therefore these settler organizations have a right to live there. And that's kind of the crux of what's happening.
I always found that whenever I read or listen to people talk about the project going on, I always find it so, it's so, like, bizarre in a way that I couldn't see it happen. Like Felix was saying in the opening, I couldn't see this happening in any other circumstance where anyone, you know, gets an ethnic, you know, we get to say no ethnicity can live here aside from us.
Yeah, not even land back says that.
Yeah.
Like, well, which is funny because, like, a lot of the people that are for Israel are not for things like land back, which is an anti-colonial decolonization effort started in the United States, I think, but is really global.
Well, yeah, obviously, because
everywhere
Zionism is a colonial effort. So,
I mean, yeah.
Why would you think that America should be decolonized? I mean, a lot of these people also think that America should be a Christian ethnostate. You know, that only Christians should be allowed to run for office, and you know, it's a Christian nation, you know?
Oh, man, yeah, no, I...
Which is interesting to note because the you know, Christian nationalists were also the origins of the Zionist movement as well.
Yeah.
Like we talked about in the previous episode.
Well, what I always find hilarious about the Christian nationalists is that basically we have been, like, de facto, like, yeah, de jure we're secular, we don't have a state religion, but, like, de facto, like, nearly every politician in our country has been friggin' Christian. So, like, I mean,
yeah, they at least say
bottom,
they are,
or they say they are, and, you know, just to,
they,
like,
have to,
like, the first few presidents, I remember there were a few, like, deists among the founding fathers, which is, like, basically, like, Christianity without the religious trappings. It's very much like it just says, like, there's a God that you can't interact with, and I believe in it, and it is, like, the origin of all life and stuff. But
I didn't even know.
But
about,
like,
that.
There's no, like, like
I know none of the presidents that have been alive.
I don't think any presidents were deists. I think it was founding fathers. I don't want to twist it in my mind.
I'm just saying, like, in my lifetime, every president, every major politician that I can think of, at least you know, goes to church and says they're Christian, you know?
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, you couldn't be atheist back in those, like, deist was as far as you could go if you were, like, the kind of person who, like, you just couldn't get office. I mean, you still can't barely get into office as a
some local
atheist.
Politicians can pull it off, but, you know, at the at the federal level, it's still pretty consistent.
Name one senator. Like, I don't know any atheist senators.
I'm not sure if Bernie Sanders is
he's Jewish.
Oh, right. Okay.
I thought.
Okay.
The resistance led to a brutal police crackdown. And what was interesting, and what was kind of dumb on the Israeli police's part, is this crackdown was filmed. It was filmed every day on live coverage from the residents. They would be, you know, streaming on Instagram Live to hundreds of thousands of people in the Arab world, in the diaspora, in the U.S., all over the world. You know, media outlets were starting to cover it. And every day, the Israeli police would come in, would crack down on the solidarity protesters who would show up, especially during Ramadan, when a lot of Jerusalemites would go to Sheikh Jarrah and break their fast, kind of in a communal way, outside these threatened homes, and then the settlers and the soldiers would attack them day after day on camera. And as you can imagine, that led to kind of like an uptick in anger and tension. And it was coupled with, the other thing we can't leave out, is it was coupled with a lot of Israeli police crackdowns outside Sheikh Jarrah, but on the old city of Jerusalem. So during Ramadan, when a lot of people would want to go pray in Al-Aqsa, which is the third holiest site in Islam, it's the kind of the national symbol for Palestinians, it's a mosque that's in Jerusalem. The Israeli police put up barricades, they limited who would go in and out, they would violently attack young men. And again, you know, it was kind of like a feedback loop, where the more the Israelis cracked down, the more kind of this rage and anger amongst a lot of Palestinians was spreading, and solidarity was spreading as well.
Could you imagine how you would feel if you were doing your Fish Friday during Lent, and the police started coming in and, like, breaking the thing up and saying who could come in and who couldn't, and attacking people, and, like, yeah, you'd be mad.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so what I've seen in the news outlets that I was able to scrape up regarding this, the claim is that supposedly rocks were quote-unquote stockpiled inside the mosque.
Oh,
and then
my
people
God.
Were throwing them at the police. And it's like, I find that extremely hard to believe.
You have bullets.
Yeah, the IDF have literal bullets. They say, oh, rubber-coated steel. It's still steel. It'll still go through a body. Like,
I just...
Yeah.
I mean, first off, yes, I doubt that really was happening. But
I mean, I'm sure if some rocks were thrown at police, but I highly doubt that they were stockpiling them.
Yeah.
Why would you? They're on the ground.
Yeah.
Like, they're already on the ground everywhere. It's a very easy claim for media to make. You see where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Anyway.
They used tear gas in the mosque.
Tear gas in
the
mosque.
No, no, no. Okay, I think they used stun grenades in the mosque. But I know tear gas has been used on the streets. Stun grenades in the mosque.
I mean, like, this is so easy to just, like, oh, it's just some people over there, and just not picture, like, as if it were relatable, you know. But these are just...
Oh, here's another.
These are just people who, like, live in a city and have normal lives, and they're just going to church. They're going to break their fast, you know.
Doing the Ramadan.
And then stun grenades. I just, that's so, I don't know. Maybe there were people who were, you know, planning resistance stuff that were there. But, like, yeah, that's not.
I feel like if
again,
if
I just keep coming back to picturing,
it's different. You don't go after the whole crowd if you're going after one terrorist.
Yeah, but well, that's my point. It's like, I just keep picturing, like, yeah, there's like two people off in the corner talking about some, you know, plot to do something at the fish fry for Lent, and, you know, the police come in and start, you know, kicking around your grandma. You know, it just it's that, talk about indiscriminate.
Yeah. Oh, here's another war crime for you. A field clinic, that's a medical little medical thing that someone set up outside near the mosque, was also broken into by the police, And they fired stun grenades into that, too. That's literally a war crime, according to the Geneva Conventions.
Yikes.
Like, attacking medics is a war crime. Or, sorry, go on.
No, that's fine. Let's just, you know, keep on moving and listen to a bit about Hamas's threat to the IDF in response to these, you know, the evictions and the
violence and specifically the aggression.
And at a certain point, the Palestinian factions in Gaza, particularly Hamas and the armed wing of Hamas, told the Israelis, warned the Israelis, made a statement that, you know, if the Israelis didn't back off of Al-Aqsa and Sheikh Jarrah, then there would be consequences. And I think it's key here. We hear a lot about the kind of the imbalance of power, and it's key to talk about that here. Hamas threatening Israel with, you know, with retribution if it didn't leave Sheikh Jarrah alone was important because for the first time, Palestinians in Jerusalem felt like they had someone who would be their defender, right? Now, Hamas is the only... Hamas and, you know, Islamic Jihad and the factions in Gaza are the only kind of factions amongst the Palestinians that have arms, that have built some kind of resistance capability or military resistance capability. And so at a time when Israel was, you know, kind of reveling in the fact that the Palestinians have become very disconnected, disunited, there was a lot of, there was a shift on the ground when the factions in Gaza and the resistance in Gaza kind of explicitly linked that threat to protecting the people in Jerusalem. And then from there, we get to where we are now, which is Israel on its ninth day of completely pounding Gaza after rockets were fired.
Did people not feel that Fatah would defend Palestinians in Jerusalem in the same way as Hamas?
So one thing actually that's really interesting, because you were asking about Fatah and Hamas and people in Jerusalem, did they not feel like Fatah would ever protect them? And I mean, Fatah, for those who don't know, is the other major Palestinian faction, right? It's the one that kind of runs the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas is the chairman of Fatah. But no, Fatah has no, as a party and as a power, has essentially been destroyed. And it's been destroyed by Mahmoud Abbas because, you know, his survival is predicated on the approval of the Israelis and the Americans. Palestinian Authority's sole role now that there's no chance for a two-state solution, now that there's no chance for any kind of Palestinian state because the Israelis have taken so much of the land. The only reason he exists is as a security force that helps enforce the occupation. So Palestinian activists in the West Bank, they are under threat of, you know, arrest and torture by the Palestinian Authority as much as by the Israelis. Anytime there's any kind of attack by a Palestinian on, say, like an Israeli checkpoint, it's the Palestinian Authority that kind of take the lead in trying to track down who it was and passing on that intelligence to the Israelis. And so Fatah as a force has essentially dissipated, right? And so, no, there was no one calling for Fatah to protect them in Sheikh Jarrah because Fatah has no capacity to do so, like neither politically nor militarily. It's a disarmed political movement that essentially only exists on paper in Mahmoud Abbas's office.
I was trying to think of some sort of a metaphor to make that relatable. I just can't think of any. It's just so, like, yeah, obviously the people who are, like, working with the people doing the thing you don't like aren't going to be the people you're going to go to.
What do you mean, existing? Living there? Having a house?
Yeah, well, yeah. No, I mean, the people who are, yeah, who are making it so that you can't exist. I mean, I'm trying to generalize it more to make it more relatable. But, like, yeah, you wouldn't go to the people who are, you know, supporting, yeah, the colonization project to defend you from the colonization project.
You're not going to go to the bully to ask for protection from the bully. And if you are, that's literally just the mob.
Yeah.
That's not a state. That's not a functioning government. That's not citizenship. That's not having human rights. You know, if you believe in all of these things.
So anyway,
as many liberal Zionists claim to.
So anyway, let's listen to some information about Hamas.
Hamas is, you know, a lot of people, I think, misunderstand Hamas. I like to think of Hamas as almost two organizations. You've got kind of the political side, which is pretty incompetent and, like, embarrassingly so. You know, they've never been able to provide any kind of vision for Palestinian liberation. They've never been able to kind of unify Palestinians as a whole around any kind of program. They've never really been able to advocate for Palestinian liberation or Palestinians in any way that's been effective, right? And some of that is due to Israeli pressure and, you know, and campaigns, including assassinations and more. But the other side of Hamas is the military wing. And the military wing has, if you look at the trajectory of the growth of the military wing, it's going one way, right? So especially since 2005, when the Israelis pulled out of Gaza, and for the first time Palestinians had a territory that, despite being, you know, infiltrated by spies and being surveilled 24/7, Palestinians had a bit of space to kind of build some kind of military capacity. And that's what the military wing of Hamas has been doing diligently in, like, the last decade and a half. For the first time, Palestinians are able to fire long-distance rockets that reach every area of, you know, historic Palestine. There's a symbolism to that, right? It's the first time Palestinians have any kind of weaponry that can attack Israelis anywhere. Now, obviously, a lot of people will say that, you know, indiscriminate rockets are a war crime, and, you know, I'll defer to, like, Human Rights Watch on that. They say it is. But the idea is we're talking about a guerrilla war army fighting a battle for what they see, that they're fighting a liberation battle, right? There's this tendency to kind of look at Hamas as simultaneously, like, the most evil, devious people on the planet, but also, like, bumbling fools who don't know how to fire a rocket without blowing themselves up. And Palestinians on the ground, especially since 2014, when I think the Palestinian resistance in Gaza surprised the Israelis with how tenacious it was, there's been a generation that's grown up and actually looks at them as, you know, the protectors of the cause, protectors of the only people they have in the world who are going to protect them from the Israelis. The disparity in power is so large that effectively they can't really be protectors, but they're the only people who will fight on behalf of the Palestinians. When Mohammed Dif, who's the commander of Hamas's military wing, and essentially the commander of all the resistance movements in Gaza, this is a guy who has never been seen in public. There's only one picture of him that exists. He's like the number one on Israel's kill list and has been for 20 years. He never speaks. Anytime he does, it's like audio only. And he's only ever spoken in public three or four times. And usually that would have been during a war. But he came out with a recorded audio message, you know, supporting the families in Sheikh Jarrah and threatening the Israelis with violence if they don't leave the families in Sheikh Jarrah alone and if they don't stop storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the other provocation that keeps getting missed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he did that, and between that and, like, the first rockets being fired, there was about 10, 12 days. So, you know, the Israelis had time to kind of tone it down, and they didn't. And one thing that stood out to me was how many protesters, how many people chanting just in Jerusalem in the streets, see them on video, chanting his name, right? A lot of people, they don't look at Mahmoud Abbas as, you know, as the leader of the Palestinians. They don't look at, like, any of Hamas's political leaders. It's this guy whose face no one has ever seen, right? Who's Israel's number one most wanted man. That's the guy that a lot of people in Palestine are chanting for across the West Bank, inside, you know, Palestinian towns in Israel, in Jerusalem, as well as Gaza. So there's been kind of a shift in how a lot of Palestinians look at the military resistance in Gaza.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't really make living in a war zone relatable to people who don't live in a war zone, to be fair.
Well, yeah, I don't want there to be any situations where, like, the guy who does the fighting is the guy that everyone looks up to, and whenever I see that, it makes me sad.
It certainly makes me worried. It makes me anxious. I don't know if it makes me sad. there are a lot of things that are going on here that would make me sad, but I don't know. Like, that's just, like, something that
it
would
just speaks
like,
to the
worry.
Desperateness of the situation, you know?
Yeah, I guess so.
Shajara has kind of made it into the news a lot over the last month because the Israeli courts announced that in May, early May, it was going to remove two families and then several more later in the year. And these families put up, you know, pretty heroic resistance considering that they have no weapons, they have no protection from the courts, from the Israeli state, and the Israeli state is actually colluding hand in glove with these settler organizations to remove them from their homes. The resistance kind of, sparked a lot of solidarity amongst Palestinians. We look at the military capabilities of resistance movements or liberation movements, the rockets that Hamas are firing, the tunnels that they built, the drones that they built, you know, it's incredible what they've been able to achieve under this like crippling blockade. A lot of people would say, well, they should have spent the money on hospitals and schools. I'm like, yeah. And then the Israelis always bomb those every time there's a flare up, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, when the Israelis left Gaza in 2005,
Israel just ordered the shutdown of the biggest medical facility in I believe it was in Gaza specifically, but in the Palestinian occupied territories for the next 6 months at least. Which is
they just ordered the shutdown of it.
Yeah, I'll pull up the details, but they just yep, you're closed now because we're the government. We can tell you to shut down.
A Hamas rocket, a homemade rocket.
Yeah, please do find details. That's
barely travel 2 miles. Right now they're building rockets. Now they have rockets that can reach 200 miles and hit any part of Israel. So there's a trajectory there of development, military development, that I think surprises the Israelis every time. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But Palestinians, especially younger Palestinians, see that trajectory. And I think it's a source of hope for a lot of them, that Palestinians might eventually be able to build an arsenal that's able to deter Israel, not necessarily defeat Israel. Israel's, backed by the U.S. empire as a nuclear weapons, but at least to create some kind of deterrence that never was there in military terms. It's the way that, Hezbollah in South Lebanon, since the last war in 2006, has been on 15 years, but the Israelis know that if they do attack South Lebanon again or Lebanon again, Hezbollah has the capability to really hurt them, and not necessarily defeat them, but at least hurt them in a way where, any kind of war with Lebanon is not worth it. And I think that's what a lot of Palestinians are hoping the factions in Gaza are able to get to.
Yeah, and that is the thing people miss when they go, I don't get why people are mad at me. I said that Hamas should stop firing rockets.
Yeah.
Israel should too. And it's do you get the point of, having a deterrent?
Yeah.
So this doesn't happen again? That's why they're doing it.
Yep.
Yep. Speaking of, so just going back to what I was talking about really quick a moment ago.
Tell me more.
All right. In the early hours of the 9th of June, just the other day, Israeli army forces raided the Palestinian Health Work Committee headquarters in Ramallah. They broke down the door, confiscated computers and memory drives, and issued a military order forcing the office to close for 6 months. The organization has come under attack repeatedly, with employees facing harassment and arrest for its alleged affiliation with the Popular Liberation Front for Palestine, which is a Palestinian political party with an armed wing. Quote, the Health Work Committee is one of the main providers of health services in the occupied Palestinian territories, running hospitals and health clinics, providing medical care to marginalized communities. Israel's shutdown of its headquarters will have major consequences for the provision of essential health services to thousands of Palestinians. A program for women's health that was at the headquarters has now stopped as well. Unquote. Salah Higazi, Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa at Amnesty International.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's actually even worse than just Israel telling them to shut down. They took their computers and stuff, too. So, I bet a bunch of health records have been lost.
Yeah.
Treatment plans.
I don't see how you could possibly justify anything, ever doing that to anyone.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any justification.
It's some vague...
It
was literally just some vague, they might have ties to... group of people who wants there to be liberation. That's what you just said.
Yeah. A couple of employees, like, supposedly involved with, yeah, a group that wants Palestinian liberation. Okay. Like, you know, there aren't even any clear, like, accusations of, like, you know,
yeah,
anything violent related. Just, like, just having a political affiliation was enough.
Yeah.
You know, when the first rockets were fired, I saw a lot of people, oh, this is so stupid. This is taking attention away from Sheikh Jarrah. I mean, if you look at it from kind of, like, that perspective, yeah, but that doesn't reflect reality on the ground. That's the kind of thinking you get when you've been inside a think tank too long, right? Mm-hmm. But when you're on the ground and you're thinking, why is Gaza firing rockets because of Sheikh Jarrah? Well, like, Gaza doesn't exist in a different continent. Like, Palestinians are in Gaza or Palestinians in Jerusalem. It's one struggle, and they see themselves as fighting a struggle for liberation and freedom on both sides. So this idea that, you know, Hamas firing rockets isn't helpful because Israel will just go on a murderous rampage. Well, she tells Israel to stop going on murderous rampages then and stop evicting people from their homes.
And on that, about, you know, the idea of evicting people from their homes, let's have a little bit of background on the situation in Sheikh Jarrah and why it's such a focus of current events.
The Palestinians who live in Sheikh Jarrah haven't lived there for hundreds of years. Those families moved there in the 50s, in the early 50s. The reason they moved there is because they were refugees forced out by Israel from their homes near Haifa and the Mediterranean coast. When Israel was founded, 700,000 Palestinians were ethnically cleansed from the territory that became the state of Israel. That's 3/4 of the Palestinian population at the time. They were either forced out at gunpoint or they fled after hearing reports about the many massacres that were committed by Zionist paramilitaries prior to the establishment of the state of Israel. And that ethnic cleansing is the only reason and the only way that Israel was able to create a Jewish majority, right? It was deliberate ethnic engineering to force out the people who were living there, who were the majority, and create a Jewish ethno-state where Jews would be the majority in a state where they were a definite minority until just a few months prior. And so the families that moved into Sheikh Jarrah did so because at the time, Israel hadn't yet occupied the West Bank. The West Bank, including East Jerusalem, was under the governance of Jordan. And the Jordanian government, in coordination with the United Nations, had offered this plot of land in Sheikh Jarrah to these families in exchange for them giving up their refugee status, essentially giving up their claims to return to their homes in near Haifa that the Israelis had taken over. And so what happened is, after Israel occupied East Jerusalem and the West Bank and took over, is that these families who had already been ethnically cleansed from their homes once were facing the exact same thing again. We're talking about a generational cycle. And that's what makes Sheikh Jarrah so poignant, because it's not unique in the sense that, you know, Israel has been trying to kick out Palestinians from several neighborhoods in Jerusalem for the same reason. Among them Silwan, which is just south of the old city, and where a settler organization called Elad, which, you know, I believe is also registered in the U.S. as a nonprofit, and received $100 million from the Israeli-Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich, who owns Chelsea Football Club. The Guardian and BuzzFeed revealed last year that he'd actually spent $100 million on this organization that explicitly works to ethnically cleanse the village of Silwan. And kind of their reason, or their stated reason for doing it, is that there's a archaeological site under this village dating back to the times of King David, you know, thousands of years ago. And so, therefore, because King David possibly once lived there, therefore it belongs to Jewish people. So what Elad does in Silwan is they've created a archaeological park. And so, you know, slowly, bit by bit, taking over land around the houses, around the homes, in some places, bribing some of these Palestinian families, you know, after kind of choking them off, bribing them with some payment in exchange for the houses. The ones who stay behind, you know, they suffer from humiliations, checkpoints, inability to build, to grow, to expand. And they're building this archaeological park, and obviously the main it's a tourist attraction for American evangelicals. They're the main people who go there, right? That's the main audience. There was a sign at one of the kind of the pro-Palestine protests that erupted over the U.S. that stuck with me. Someone held up a sign that said, "Every Israeli town was once Sheikh Jarrah." And if you think about that, that's essentially the crux of this issue, right? Every Israeli town.
Looks like Owen says we had some technical difficulties. The cable came loose, so I'm going to restart that clip.
There was a sign at one of the kind of the pro-Palestine protests that erupted over the U.S. that stuck with me. Someone held up a sign that said, "Every Israeli town was once Sheikh Jarrah." And if you think about that, that's essentially the crux of this issue, right? Every Israeli town was once, populated by Palestinians who've been forced out and replaced with Israeli Jews. And that's why it's hilarious when the Israeli foreign ministry says that what's going on in Sheikh Jarrah is just a private real estate dispute between two private parties. It's not.
Yeah, and as we'll get to in a minute, the court system that private real estate dispute is a part of is a little biased, but I just that previous clip about the I don't remember his name, the Russian guy who bought, who paid $100 million for this project to build this this tourist trap for American evangelicals. I can't imagine the amount of good that you could do in the world with $100 million, and instead you use it to...
To build a theme park for white people?
And kick people out of their homes and
the claim by these Israeli settler organizations that the land in Sheikh Jarrah once belonged to Jews, they're using kind of like,
I mean, it once belonged
land
to the Hittites
from
too.
The Ottoman Empire.
And the Romans and the Egyptians and
the Canaanites.
Ottomans.
I mean,
the Babylonians.
Multiple
the
hominid
Persians.
Species used to live in that area. So you could say it also belonged to, like, now extinct species of hominid.
Yeah, but there's none of those around to say anything about that.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
We ate them.
To prove this. And there's question marks yes. about how valid these land deeds are. Some of them may be forgeries, some not. But what's interesting is that they're not saying we have to return this land to the people who owned it. They're saying that because Jews once lived here, then any Jew could then move in and kick out the Palestinians who live there now. And that's why you get, Jacob from Brooklyn moving in to these families' houses.
I mean, that's a crucial difference between like the land
at the same time.
And the Israeli colonization effort.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned that.
I find it odd that you keep.
Yeah, I know,
like,
right?
Comparing those two.
Yeah, no, there's something that keeps like a parallel in my mind. I mean, the part that like really spurred me to like keep like bringing this up was because like almost nobody that you see who is a Zionist is also going to support the land back movement. Like they're not generally like I think. That sort of like highlights the main difference between them, because one is a decolonization effort and the other is a colonization effort.
Yeah, I see.
The Sheikh Jarrah families are originally from, near Haifa. Israeli courts don't allow them to make a claim to return to their houses that are still there. So the Israeli courts will hear any case for any Jewish organization that wants to reclaim the land that, a Jew might not have lived in for hundreds of thousands of years. But a Palestinian who's still alive and says, I want to go back to the house that was mine a few decades ago. The Israeli court system will not hear that argument. We're not allow it. And that is kind of a testament to the apartheid system that Israel is running against Palestinians.
Where does it end?
Mm.
That has been, that has been the thing that no Israeli can really answer. Where does this stop? Does it stop at the West Bank, or where does it go?
Yeah.
Where will the last settlement be put up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think kind of the public-facing discourse that Israel for decades had pushed out, especially to the West, was that, you know, initially these settlements, you know, they'll eventually be, we'll negotiate a resolution to them with the Palestinians, right? And that was kind of the basis of the Oslo Accords on the West Bank and Gaza, and maybe there'd be some land swaps to accommodate the settlements, or maybe they'd be negotiated one way or the other. Since then, the Israeli settler population has actually tripled. So when the Palestinians and the Israelis signed the Oslo Accords, there were 200,000 settlers in the West Bank. There are now 600,000. That's one in every 10 Israeli Jews lives in a West Bank settlement, right? So the idea of where did this end? Well, for Israelis, I think, if you look at the maps they put out when they talk about Israel, there's no line marking the West Bank separate, or the Golan Heights, which is, you know, the Syrian territory that they've also annexed, or...
Yeah, it doesn't end.
Not until the Palestinians are fully cleansed, ethnically cleansed from the area.
Yeah, that's just...
The Israelis don't hide this. This isn't something that the Israelis only talk about kind of like, you know, in secret government meetings. This is Israel's basic law. So, you know, 2 years ago, 2018, 3 years ago, the Israeli Knesset passed the nation-state law. The nation-state law explicitly says that Israel is the state of the Jewish people and only them. Not of its citizens, but of the Jewish people. Right, there was a famous, I think, Israeli pop star who made a comment on Instagram or a post on Instagram at the time saying, you know, she was ashamed that this was legalized and codified into law. And Netanyahu himself replied to her on Instagram saying, you know, it's the state of the Jews only, and only the Jews have the right to self-determination in Israel. Which is crazy to think about. That's like saying, in America, only white people have the right to self-determination. Even if everyone else has citizenship, their citizenship is a different level. It's a different caste.
All right. That is, I think, all we're going to have for today. Today's clips came from Chapo Trap House number 526.
Nope. We didn't get any 526.
Oh, 236, which was a special... Go ahead.
No. 236 is free parking, which is a different discussion on Israel featuring Truanon, but we didn't even get them. No, the episode that we feature today with Felix and journalist Mohammed Al-Safin from Al Jazeera Plus is simply called Bonus Focus on Palestine. It was released a couple episodes before 236. It's still pretty recent, so like if you look them up on Apple Podcasts or anything like that, It should be like right there in the list. Scroll down a little bit, but it doesn't have a number attached.
Sure. And so this has been The Truth is So Boring on WIOX Community Radio. My name is Scott. You can find the show at thetruthissoboring.org. We have a website now. It is still a bit of a work in progress, but it does exist, and you can listen to part one of this episode where we went into the background.
Let me get that sweet URL once more.
thetruthissoboring.org.
.org. All right, and playing us out?
Do the station.
Oh, yeah, thing? Yeah.
I don't have the note in front of me, so I want to let
always,
you do it.
As always, you are listening to WIOX Community Radio, 91.3 FM, live and local in the Catskill Mountains, and MTC Cable Channel 20, also 107.5 FM on the campus of SUNY Delhi, on smart devices, through the Radio FM app, and everywhere else at WIOXradio.org. Shout out to my grandma. Hope you're listening. And it's easy to donate at WIOXradio.org if you like what you hear and want to help out. Playing us out, the illustrious, the legendary, the barely turned 30, Bo Burnham, released a new special this past May the 30th called Inside.
Which we watched last night. I said to Owen, I feel like laughing about how depressed I am. Can we watch Inside?
Yes, and it really fit the bill, let me tell you. So this is How the World Works, featuring special guest Sako. And yes, if you're wondering, yes, we cleaned it for the radio. No worries. Please enjoy. This has been The Truth is So Boring on WIOX.
Hey, kids. Today we're going to learn about the world. Thank you. that's around us is pretty amazing. But how does it work? It must be complicated. The secret is the world can only work when everything works together. A bee drinks from a flower and leaves with its pollen. A squirrel in a tree spreads the seeds that have fallen. Everything works together. The biggest elephant, the littlest fly. The gophers underground, the birds in the sky. And every single cricket, every fish in the sea gives what they can and gets what they need. Everyone, look who stopped by to say hello. It's Socko.
Hey!
Where you been, Socko?
I've been where I always am when you're not wearing me on your hand. In a frightening liminal space between states of being. Not quite dead, not quite alive. It's similar to a constant state of sleep paralysis.
Socko, we were just talking about the world and how it works.
Boy, that sounds complicated.
Do you have anything you'd want to teach us about the world?
I wouldn't say anything that you probably haven't already said yourself.
I don't know about that, Socko. How about you give it a try?
All right. The simple narrative taught in every history class is demonstrably false and pedagogically classist. Don't you know the world is built with blood and genocide and exploitation? The global network of capital essentially functions to separate the worker from the means of production. And the FBI killed Martin Luther King. Private property's inherently theft. And neoliberal fascists are destroying the left. And every politician, every cop on the street protects the interests of the pedophilic corporate elite. That is how the world works.
Really?
That is how the world works. Genocide the natives, say you got to it first. That's how it works.
That's pretty intense.
No shit.
What can I do to help?
Read a book or something, I don't know. Just don't burden me with the responsibility of educating you. It's incredibly exhausting.
I'm sorry, Socko. I was just trying to become a better person.
Why do you rich fucking white people insist on seeing every socio-political conflict through the myopic lens of your own self-actualization? This isn't about you. So either get with it or get out of the fucking way.
Watch your mouth, buddy. Remember who's on whose hand here.
But that's what I'm... Have you not been fucking listening? We are entrenched
Wait,
no, please, I don't want to go back. I can't go back. Please. I'm sorry.
Are you going to behave yourself?
Yes.
Yes. What?
Yes, sir.
Look at me.
Yes, sir.
That's better. That is how the world works.
That is how the world works.
I hope you learned your lesson.
I did and it hurt. That's how it